Welcome to The Property Wizard. If you are brand new to the real estate investment world or have limited experience, you've come to the right place. Freddie Crouch has over 35 years of real estate investing experience. He's seen it all, and he's ready to share it with you. This podcast takes an inside look at investing in real estate, what to look for, and most of all, how to move forward. Please welcome the property wizard, Freddie.
Welcome back, listeners. A big thank you to the team at Carl Speaks, headed up by no other than Mr. Podcast himself, Carl Richards. We would especially like to acknowledge and thank our producer, Kieran Doherty. Without him, we just wouldn't sound as good as we like to think we do. And supporting this awesome duo are Nathan Simon, who created the original sound score, and Caroline Nicolai, who every episode supplies us with new cover artwork. Thank you, everyone, for a wonderful effort. Apologies, listeners, we haven't had a new podcast for a little longer than we like right now, but we've been hard at work at the new Gentry Learning Program, and Bernie and I are going to have a podcast specifically dealing with that issue about the courses being offered by Gentry Learning very, very shortly. So, Bernie, a recap from the previous podcast when we talked to Michael Lewicki about the world of condominiums. What did you think of that one?
I found it fascinating because the operations that run a condo are made up of people that live in the condo, but may not have the expertise of a typical property management organization. And at the end of the day, it sounds like they need to have their subject matter experts available to counsel them on different processes. Legal ramifications.
Yeah, for sure. And Mike most certainly is your subject matter expert. Boy, oh boy, I think if we would have let him go, he could have spoken nonstop about condominiums for the next 8 hours. Just an incredible wealth of knowledge. He was particularly a good guest. Wonderful. Great. You've got me. So, anything in the mailbag today, Bernie?
Well, Fred, yes. Actually, Josh in St. Petersburg, he's in Florida, wrote that he just bought a small commercial building with four stores, and he's a little overwhelmed by the amount of work he stepped into. Two of the four stores are vacant, and he's wondering how far he can take the repairs and renovations to these vacant units before putting the units back onto the market for lease.
Thank you, Josh, for your question. Always nice to hear from our listeners in St. Petersburg. Congratulations on your recent investment. There are two points I would like to address. The first is that most commercial tenants will expect to have to do their own leasehold improvements to fit their specific needs, very often to offset the monies the tenant will pay towards their improvements. The landlord, meaning you, Josh, will provide the tenant with a certain amount of months of free basic rent. What you should be doing is taking the leasable space back to the dividing walls. So if you're doing anything more than what I've just described, you should stop now. Instead, spend your available funds on a promotion campaign to get your units rented. The second point is that prior to purchasing any investment property, you should have a game plan in place to minimize cash flow disruptions by getting the space leased in the shortest period of time. And I can't emphasize that enough. That's very, very important. And we talk about this, Bernie, and I don't know, just about every other episode we do. It's important to have your team. You should have a leasing agent. Can be a realtor, can be a management company. You should have someone who's maybe a little more experienced when it comes to doing the renovation or leasehold improvements. And as I emphasized before, when you're dealing with commercial space, it's fine to have the mechanical systems in place. It's fine to have an HVAC unit in place. It's fine to have electrical brought to the unit. But each and every tenant is not the same. You know, one tenant may require a certain amount of power load or a floor plan that suits his purposes. Another may have a completely different use and purpose for the space. So the safest thing you can do is take the available space back to the dividing walls. And when I say dividing walls, I'm usually talking about the firewalls. Most commercial, in your particular case, it's a strip plaza. I haven't seen pictures of it, but that's what I'm anticipating it is. Chances are each of the units will have a cinder block dividing wall, a fireproof wall. So I hope that helps. If you need anything else, give us a shout. Thanks for the question, Josh.
Our second question is from Jacques from Montreal, Quebec, and he writes, He has an opportunity to buy a hunting camp owned by a guide in northwestern Quebec. From what he has explained to him, that he has an exclusive license to hunt and fish on these lands for the next 14 years. Is this something I should be interested in investing in?
Well, interesting question. And I came across just this type of scenario last spring. So thank you for your question, Jean. The short answer, not unless there is a considerable upside brought about by income through guiding, licensing, or the rental of cabins on the property. However, if you absolutely love to hunt and fish, and this has always been a dream of yours, then the simple question you have to ask yourself is the amount that I'm considering investing more or less than what it would cost me if I were to pay retail to hunt and fish the area with a guide for the period of time the guy has remaining on his exclusive license? So at the end of the day, this is the point that I'm trying to make. If he's come to you and he suggested or you've offered to invest $100,000 in a hunting camp, and he's told you that he operates his hunting camp through a license, in this case, it would be the province of Quebec. What you have to determine is, let's say there's 10 years left in the license, can you garner $10,000 a year worth of benefit from your investment in this hunting camp? Because otherwise, you're much better off if you went hunting or fishing 2, 3, 4 times a year and it cost $1,000, $2,500 each time, then it takes care of itself. It equals out. If you went 4 times a year and to go on a hunting trip, it was going to cost you $2,500 per trip, then that's your $10,000. Can you garner $10,000 a year in benefit? That's only a question you can answer. So I can't be more definitive than that. But those are the things. It's really simple mathematical equation. Again, money in, money out. You have to get a certain amount of benefit. Remember, you're not buying a hard asset. You're buying, essentially leasing the right to hunt and fish on that land for the remaining term the guide has a license to hunt and fish on it. So again, thank you very much for your question. Very interesting. Great.
So if you have any questions, please send your emails to info@gentryres.com. That's info@gentryres.com. And of course, also realize if there are no problems,
there are no opportunities.
From the current events desk of the Property Wizard, it's news of the week.
Welcome back, listeners. Today, we're going to address a question I'm asked a great deal, and it's about investing in Florida real estate. I thought it was an appropriate topic, and today I'm leaning pretty heavy on our friends at Mash Visor, who are a property research and analytical firm. And I came across an article that was written not all that long ago, and I thought I'd just go over it for everyone's benefit. It addresses the question, what makes Florida an attractive investment location? And this is pretty recent. This is like this year recent. So let's just go over these points. Number one, a vacation way of life. Most of us up here in the Northern Hemisphere would have to suggest that we only go to Florida for, you know, really the entertainment value or for a little bit of R&R. Florida, I don't know about our guests, and I don't know about Bernie, but I've been down there so often, I can't count. When was the last time you were in Florida, Bernie?
Been down there. It's wonderful. Great sun, great beaches. I love it.
That's wonderful. That's good to hear, Bernie, because most everyone I know has been down to Florida. I know I've probably been down to the sunny state between 45 and 50 times all day long. My favorite place to fish, bar none. So, back to the question, what makes Florida an attractive investment location? A vacation way of life. The second point that our friends at Mash Visor have pointed out is its cultural diversity. And it's a good point because people from all over the U.S. and Canada migrate down to Florida. So you'll see all sorts of demographic down there, all sorts. Another point they make is a shift in lifestyle preferences. And this is what they say about it. This new mindset has led many to relocate to Florida, known for its warm climate, natural sceneries, theme parks, and relaxed tax laws, which is very, very important to keep in mind. Florida has no personal income tax. And I don't know how many of you knew that, but it is one of the few states where commercial enterprise float the state economy. And they do. Take a look, for instance, you know, Disney World. I mean, is there a theme park like that anywhere else in the world? The billions of dollars that it must generate is just, you know, beyond comprehension, really. So another point they make is just about Florida's real estate. They say that the cash on cash return for long-term rentals in the state averages a little better than 4%. Now, that's cash on cash return. That may not sound like it's an incredible return, but it's a respectable return. But then again, remember, we're talking about cash on cash return, and we're not talking about the increase in equity caused by the natural tendency of real estate to increase in value. But cash on cash return, a little better than 4%, not too bad. So the next point they make is a point that I made earlier about Florida's affordability. Florida is one of the few states in the country that produces enough revenue from the commercial industry to avoid collecting personal income tax. Well, I don't know about our guests, and I don't know about Bernie, but boy, oh boy, that's a pretty attractive incentive. So the next point that they make is just the wages and workforce. You know, they say that the workforce in Florida is highly qualified, technically proficient, and culturally and linguistically diversified. So those are all wonderful reasons to turn around and invest in Florida. So they've broken this down, the study down even further into the best places to invest for long-term rentals and the best places to invest for short-term rentals. So I'm not going to get into the details of each and every one, but let's just rhyme off the top five in the long-term rental category. So number one on their list is Vero Beach. Vero Beach. Next is Naples, Naples, Florida. That just so happens to be near the 10,000 Islands where I love fishing all the time. North Miami, Lantana. And picking up the rear at number five is Tampa, Tampa. And there's a number of other ones that they suggest, but those are your top five. So the other part of the equation is they have a list of best places to invest in Florida real estate for short-term rentals. Now, here we're talking about your Airbnbs, you know, weekend or weekly rentals, anything less than a regular term. So there's a little bit of a preamble I'll just touch on. The folks at MashVisor say Florida remains a popular vacation destination for Americans and foreigners alike. The state continues to draw vacationists like a magnet because of its tropical climate, scenic spots, and tourist attractions. And that's true. Although the tourism industry in Florida went to a halt in 2020, all because of our friend COVID, it rebounded these past 2 years, attracting a total of over 97 million visitors from January to September. That's the first 9 months of 2022. So let's get on to the best places to invest for short-term rentals. Number one on MashVisor's list is Brandon. Number two, Inverness. Number three, Fort Pierce. Number four, Palm Bay, which is the only one so far that I can point at exactly on a map. And number five, Winter Haven. And again, there are another, you know, half dozen or so best places to invest for short-term rentals. MashVisor finishes up the report by saying we expect that by the end of 2023, the days on market will have greatly grown. It will take significantly longer to sell a home than consumers have been accustomed to during the last 2 years. This is a fantastic opportunity for both buyers and sellers. If you've been waiting for a sign to take action, this is it. This is the time. Anyways, so that sums up my In the News segment. One other point I wanted to make about investing in U.S. real estate is, and I'm asked this very specific question, and I'm a little hesitant to delve into it until we have a U.S. tax expert on as a guest, but it's referencing Section 1031 of the Internal Revenue Code. And essentially what that does, and I've been asked for clarification, I'm just going to pull this right out of an article that I was researching to try to address this specific question. Section 1031 of the Internal revenue code allows investors to sell one income-producing property and buy another while deferring 100% of any capital gains tax due. Now, what does that mean? That means you bought a property, you made a great deal of money on it, and rather than, in this case, Uncle Sam taking their share of that, they will allow you to defer that if you roll it over and buy another type of real estate. And the interesting thing about it, it doesn't have to be the same type of real estate. You can claim or benefit from this code very, very simply by, if you have an industrial or commercial building, you sell it, you can flip that over into residential. It doesn't matter. But the point is that your gains from the sale of the previous property are not taxable if you roll them over and buy another property. So very, very interesting. I'm sorry I can't get into it anymore, but we'll have to wait until we actually have a bona fide tax expert on to deal with that specific question. So let's move on. Well, listeners, we have a real treat for you today. In our ongoing pursuit of excellence, we have tapped Cambian on the shoulder again to bring to us two very, very, I hope you find them very interesting speakers. And today we're going to talk about property condition assessments, or PCAs, or in some areas they're known as building surveys. Now, what are building surveys? What do they consist of? Well, these two are going to answer all your questions. So first, I'd like to introduce Matthew Fagan. He's a project coordinator dealing specifically with building science. Matthew Fagan is an experienced project coordinator within the building science discipline at Cambian Inc. And we've had several guests from Cambian, and we have a few more scheduled. Mr. Fagan has over 7 years of working in the consulting and building science industry with a background in construction. Mr. Fagan is an experienced and trained thermographer. Matthew has a professional focus on building property condition assessments, reserve fund studies, detailed construction and building envelope reviews. Matthew has completed hundreds of baseline building condition assessments for industrial, commercial, institutional, and residential buildings throughout Canada for a wide range of purposes, including due diligence, acquisition, and finance and divestiture. Additionally, Matthew routinely completes phase one environmental assessments for the environmental due diligence and remediation and designated substance surveys for the hazardous material service lines. The second part of this duo is Jeremy Taylor. Jeremy is a group manager of the building science service team at Cambian. He has over 12 years experience in completing property condition assessments, PCAs, reserve fund studies, RFAs. Really appreciate the acronyms. You can never have too many acronyms in your life. And performance audits, PAs across Canada. Jeremy is a civil engineer with a Bachelor of Applied Science from the University of Waterloo in 2007. The first 4 years of his career began in structural engineering, where he carried out analysis and design of new and existing buildings. Mr. Taylor has reviewed hundreds of buildings in his career, including commercial, multi-unit residential, industrial, institutional, recreational, and educational, as well as building sizes ranging from single-family homes to multi-building Class A commercial office properties. He has a strong understanding of major building systems and components, their failure mechanisms, and repair and replacement strategies and costs, including structural framing, building envelope and roofing, mechanical, plumbing, electrical, fire and life safety, vertical transportation, and fire and life safety systems. So vertical transportation, for those maybe not in the know, would normally be called elevators. In some parts of the world, lifts, but elevators. One of Jeremy's passions is making connections through teaching. Since working as a math tutor as a young adult, he enjoys helping clients understand the subject material to make informed decisions. He also mentors colleagues in technical subjects, nurturing professional development and career growth. Well, 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 what a couple of bios. And believe you me, it's not everything they sent me. So welcome to the show, Jeremy, Matthew.
Thank you for having us.
Pleasure, Fred. Thank you.
Beautiful. Well, Again, now this is a topic that kind of, and we're going to get into the questions, but a lot of people, when they first receive a request for a property condition assessment or building survey, they don't have any idea what they're being asked. So I don't want to delve into the questions that we have yet, but it's a very, very interesting topic, and I'm sure we're going to learn a great deal. So let me start right off. Let's start by explaining to our listeners what the difference is between a building location survey and a building survey slash property condition assessment, or PCA. Boys?
Happy to address that. So a building location survey is typically completed by a registered land surveyor. So the purpose of this is to establish the legal boundaries of the property. So this is where they're going out with, you know, a tripod and other instruments and preparing a set of drawings that show where the property boundaries lie. In Ontario, these are completed by an Ontario land surveyor. A building survey or a property condition assessment is similar to a residential home inspection, but typically done for larger buildings and commercial real estate assets. So the process is based on a visual review of the property, and the outcome is a report that describes the major building components, their present condition, and opinions of cost for repair and replacement over a set period of time. So for example, a portion of the report would describe the type of roofing system, roughly how old it is, any deficiencies observed, and its overall condition, and whether or not the roof needs to be maintained or repaired or replaced, when, and how much the dollar values. And so we repeat that for all of the major building systems that exist on that property. And also for reference, a property condition assessment, a PCA, is also referred to as a building condition assessment, a BCA, or a facility condition assessment. And there's various interchangeable terms that you might hear.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for that explanation. Bernie?
So from the environmental aspect or component, is there one to a building survey? Do you take into account, for example, asbestos, or perhaps the dark side, mold?
There are a few different environmental aspects and components that are involved and some that are not involved with a PCA. We look at how the environment mainly has impacted the building systems and components, for example, through UV exposure, freeze thaw damage, but we don't look at environmental issues like contaminated soils as part of the PCA itself. In accordance with the ASTM E2018 standard, a typical PCA has exclusions or limitations. We generally don't comment on improvements that may be required. We don't carry out design calculations. We don't comment on soil type, subsurface conditions, and we don't assess or comment on environmental issues such as water quality, asbestos, hazardous materials, indoor air quality. That said, many consultants provide overlapping services. One such is a phase one environmental site assessment, which is often completed in conjunction with a PCA for commercial real estate transaction or financing. Banks and lending institutions typically have a dollar value that'll trigger when a PCA or phase one needs to be completed. If major issues are noted in the phase one, the assessment is often elevated to a phase two, which is a more detailed scope of work. Another such study that I do complete on a regular basis is a hazardous material and designated substance surveys. This is a process of visually reviewing building systems and components for specific biological, chemical, radioactive hazards by collecting samples of these materials, testing it, and providing a report. In blatant terms, this is where you would hear mold survey or asbestos survey.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. So this kind of flows very nicely into the next question. If a building being surveyed has a doctor, dentist office or offices, are they scrutinized for environmental issues, concerns, or is that outside the mandate of those conducting the building survey?
So the activities of the occupants, including the process-related equipment, is typically outside of the mandate of the PCA. If we do note obvious concerns that are outside of the scope of work, we can still make recommendations for additional review. When it comes to completing the PCA as a whole, the general practice is that tenant or occupant that's within the building doesn't really factor in a sense. The main focus is the building itself, the shell, the core of the building. But in certain industrial buildings that have processes, certain components or machinery that are used, still need to be considered. So that may be in the HVAC systems, in the electrical or lighting systems, where it is essential to the operation of the building.
What are some of the other components of a building survey?
So there's multiple components that we would look at with a building survey or property condition assessment. These things include site works, like the hard surfacing, retaining walls, fencing, landscaping around the property, the structure itself going from the roof, the floor, the walls, beams, columns, basements, foundation walls, balconies, parking garages, and any kind of suspended access systems that the building may have. On top of that, the building envelope as a whole, which would include your walls, windows, doors, the actual roof itself. There's the plumbing, hot and cold water, the drainage, mechanical systems, including heating, ventilation, air conditioning, electrical and lighting, fire and life safety, everything from the fire alarm panel to sprinkler and standpipe systems, as well as the emergency generators, and including elevators.
Wonderful. Thanks. That's a very detailed list for sure. So under what circumstances, and you touched on it a little earlier, but under what circumstances would a building survey or property condition assessment be normally ordered? Who's calling you and asking you to do this?
It's often the banks and lending institutions that have their own policies that require a PCA and or a phase one ESA based on the assessed dollar value of the property. And they use that to assess and manage risk. The need can range from purchasing to selling to refinancing a building. And we also see that building owners or property managers may request a PCA to help with capital planning. And it's a tool that will help identify issues and deficiencies, prioritize repair projects, and develop capital budgets. And this could be done for their own due diligence. And once we complete a PCA report for a client, we're often required to provide a reliance letter. And that allows the bank or the lending institution to rely on the consultant, on our insurance. And so that's how they use that to protect themselves.
Bernie.
So in regards to when you're doing the survey, you also take, for example, if someone has done a capital infrastructure upgrade, say the HVAC, the chiller, and it comes with a warranty, does that also influence the analysis?
Yeah. So when we're gathering information about the building, if we understand that the roof or the mechanical systems have been recently replaced, there usually is some amount of warranty depending on the type of work. We request these documents. We don't always get them. But if there are deficiencies and something's not functional or the roof is leaking after it was recently replaced, those types of repairs usually are covered under warranty. So we do need to make some assumptions in our report as to whether the repairs are going to be completed under warranty or not. And so we will state that. And so the report should clearly say or indicate whether the line items for repairs are included under warranty or not.
Fair enough. So if I want to do a building survey or an analysis of my building, do you base the cost on square footage, location of the premises, industry type?
I can answer that for you. As you might expect, cost depends on various factors. We price the work based on pretty much how much time we think it's going to need, locations, etc. In Canadian dollars, you're probably looking at around this.
I think Bernie's question was about, are you talking about the cost of the component, like when we are preparing an opinion of cost, or are you talking about the cost just to do the property condition assessment?
The cost of doing the property condition assessment. In other words, buddy comes up and says, I've gone through one for a 15-story building, right? And so certain age factors, you know, size, complexity. Yeah. But, you know, if that was a residential space, it might be totally different than say, listen, I got a nuclear power plant. Come take a peek, right?
Yeah. So when it comes to the cost of a building conditions assessment or building survey, there's a lot of things that need to sort of be factored in. We price the work a lot of the time sort of on how much time we think is going to need to go into that project, location, geographically where it's at, et cetera. In Canadian dollars, you can kind of expect around $3,000 for sort of your typical small walk-up apartment buildings and things like that. You can see around $4,000 to $6,000 for medium-sized properties, which might include sort of your lighter industrial warehouses and your sort of smaller multi-tenant commercial buildings where you're going to be looking at multiple components and different areas inside that building. At a really high end of things, larger buildings and complexes like AAA commercial plazas can sometimes be in the order $15,000 to $20,000. Things that we could kind of consider is sort of the age of the building, whether there's been lots of additions. We see buildings that are 50, 60 years old that have seen 18 different additions. So you don't know where one thing starts and one thing ends. The overall size, type of elements that we're going to need to review. Are there balconies? This is an additional structural thing to look at. Parking garage, whole other beast that you're looking at. Elevators, are mechanical, electrical systems, are they your simple everyday ones you see, or are there more complex systems? Whether the construction is uniform, regular, or highly variable, and sort of the occupancy type as well. Is it your residential apartment? What kind of industrial work are they doing? What kind of things are they using in that building? Location matters, as we typically account for travel-related costs as well and fees. And also, is it a five-year report for the transaction, or are they looking for a 30-year report for a long-term capital plan? Those items now, how many times are they going to need to be replaced over a 30-year versus a five-year? Things may not hit that report.
So this question flows very nicely into the explanation you've just provided us. Are outside experts utilized during a building survey or, again, property condition assessment?
So typically, we would only engage outside consultants or experts if they're needed. Historically, when commercial real estate PCAs were completed, there would be a team consisting of an architect, a structural engineer, a mechanical engineer, and an electrical engineer. And there are still some consultants who do it this way when the client is asking for it. And they're willing to pay considerably more when you're having four different professionals as opposed to one. But nowadays, most consultants will send one or two people that are skilled, trained, and knowledgeable to review a wide variety of building systems and components. So if we encounter conditions that are outside of the mandate of our PCA, we may recommend additional assessment. That might be simply going back to review a larger sample of the building, carrying out non-destructive or destructive testing. So, for example, roof test cuts or wall test cuts, drywall test cuts. And we may recommend engaging specialists. So that might be fire safety or building code consultants, accessibility consultants, heritage consultants, or elevator specialists. Elevator specialists is particularly important because, in accordance with the technical standards, we cannot go into an elevator pit. We can't go into the shaft. We're not allowed to do that. And so we base our review on the age of the system, the information gathered from the site representatives and the service contractors, but we're not able to physically see some of the major systems inside the shaft.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point, because I remember very specifically not that long ago doing a building where everything was done except for the elevator shaft. And when I questioned it, they gave me the explanation you just did. And sure enough, the following day, there was, I guess, a provincially certified elevator inspection, you know, conducted. I'm not sure of the qualifications you need to do that, but it was very thorough. They were measuring gaps to, you know, efficiencies of like inches and half inches. And it was really quite an education. I watched them do it without going into the pit.
Yeah, it's pretty comprehensive when they're doing a performance assessment. They're measuring times from the start and stop of the elevator movement, the starting and opening of doors, the closing times, all of the gaps around it. And there's all kinds of safety considerations for pinching and entrapment of not only the people who are using the elevators on a day-to-day basis, but the workers who work in and around and on top of the elevator.
Great. Thank you for that explanation. So how long would a typical property condition assessment take to complete?
So for smaller size buildings, as Matt described, it may take one person a few hours, say 2 to 4 hours on site. Medium buildings may be closer to a full day. And larger buildings, we would usually have a team of people split it up so that we can still cover the building in a full day. In terms of getting the report, ideally, we'd like to have around 3 to 4 weeks, 20 business days from completing the site visit to issuing the report. But we also live in the real world, and real estate transactions are typically not that forgiving. So for smaller and medium-sized buildings, we can turn a site visit and report around in a shorter time frame, say 10 to 15 business days. But there may be increased costs in getting it done that quickly. We may need to send more expensive people just for scheduling and resource availability.
Thank you for that. Very, very important. Our last question for the two of you, and we touched on this a little earlier during the podcast, is Is there a difference between a building survey or property condition assessment and a reserve fund study, which you would normally use for a condominium? It sounds to me there's a lot of very, very similar components.
Absolutely. There are definitely similarities, but they are also quite different things. So one of the main outcomes or deliverables of a PCA is a capital expenditure table. So this is a list of all of the projects that are expected to be completed over that time frame, whether that's 5 years or 10 years, the associated costs with doing that work, and what years or year they're expected to occur. A reserve fund study has all of that for a condo. In Ontario, the Ontario Condo Act requires that to be done for at least 30 years. So you have a large table full of all of these project costs, and then we carry out a financial analysis. And this is what really makes the reserve fund study unique. The financial analysis determines what the reserve fund contributions need to be, and that feeds into the total condo fees that the condominium owners pay.
Wonderful. Thank you for that explanation. So there we go. Wonderful. Thank you, Jeremy, Matt, for being our guest today. I'm sure our listeners will have all sorts of questions for you. Be prepared. What's the best way for them to reach you?
Well, if your listeners from all across North America, probably email would be best. I can be reached at jeremy.taylor@cambium-inc.com.
Myself, matt.fagan@cambium-inc.com.
Wonderful. Thank you both. And if you take a look at our podcast notes, their contact info, their emails will be listed there. So thank you very much, listeners, for joining us. Jeremy, Matt, you're not off the hook yet.
It's time for the Property Wizard's Word of the Day.
So we have a little bit of a tradition here that we always ask our guests to explain to our listeners the word of the day. So I hope you read your podcast notes, because I would like you to explain to our listeners what a field review is.
I can answer that for you, Fred. Field review, site survey, site visit, site review. They're kind of an interchangeable term for when the consultant is basically physically on site, walking around, gathering the information, talking to the site reps. This will include making the observations of the building, taking notes, photographs, which in turn will create the whole building survey or property condition report that we present to the client.
So is it fair to say that a field review is part of a property condition assessment?
Correct.
That would be an okay interpretation. Wonderful. Thank you both for being our guest today. Another really interesting podcast. Anything you care to add, Bernie?
Yeah, I think having a PCA, regardless whether you're, you know, coming at it from a banker's perspective or otherwise, having managed a property and having a PCA tells you where your upcoming issues are going to be coming, right? How to allot money for a budget, you know, in the upcoming years. That way you can create your reserve fund without going, oh no, we have to get a loan, you know, for the capital infrastructure piece. And really important, you stay ahead of the game. I've always found it extremely useful. And you go through the checklist, you know, done. It's been upgraded. Awesome. Carry on.
Yeah, that's true. That's very, very true. So listeners, join us next podcast when we'll be discussing property site assessments with guests Christine Wilson and Kurt Frohman, again from Cambium. We may as well just retitle this entire podcast, The Cambium Show. What do you think, guys? You think it'll go over well?
The Cambium Special.
Cambium Special. There we go. The Cambium Crew. I think that's the moniker we have to use. The Cambium Crew. Okay.
That sounds good. It rolls off the tongue.
Perfect. Again, thank you, listeners, for tuning in. And remember, if there are no problems,
there are no opportunities.
Thanks for joining Freddie on another edition of The Property Wizard. Got a question? Ready to invest? Email info@gentryres.com. And if you'd like to find out more about the courses offered through Gentry Learning, visit gentryres.com. Until next time, remember, if there are no problems, there are no opportunities.